Welcome to the Hackaday 2018 Year in Review podcast. My name is Mike Stish. I'm editor-in-chief of Hackaday.
Hi, and I'm Elliot Williams. I'm managing editor of Hackaday.
So every week for the last, what, 2 or 3 years, Elliot?
Yeah, just about.
We get together and talk about all of the articles that have been written and published on Hackaday.com over the previous week and what's coming up. And this year we were looking back over 2018 and realized it's been an above average, incredible year.
Yeah, and every week I put together a newsletter where I get to cover the coolest stories that went on that week in Hackaday. And a lot of people have said it's really great because we publish so many articles a week. I think we're up to 10 a day times 7 days, 70 articles a week in Hackaday that the devoted reader would have to read. So I wanted to start doing something curatorial and maybe start looking into how we could select the absolute best of Hackaday and pitch it back to you.
If you're not getting that weekly newsletter from Elliot, go check out the footer on the bottom of Hackaday.com and you can sign up for it there. Elliot, I actually think that doing that newsletter every week is kind of like cheating in preparation for this podcast because you have like a crib sheet for what the great posts of each week were. I went back and pulled every article from the past year and it's an amazing number of articles. It's really hard to figure out which are the ones that shouldn't be missed and are worth another look.
Yeah, it's really crazy. I did the same thing. I went through all of them, and I think I had something like 2,860-something articles, and I looked at every title, and I clicked on probably, oh, God knows, maybe a tenth of them, I think, and winnowed it down to my favorite 100 and then decided that it was all completely impossible and just picked three at random.
Yeah, I think my list had 3,260 articles on it. I pulled December of 2017, so we'd have a full 12 months since we're recording this in December. But my first run through of the list, I think I had 48 articles that I thought we should talk about. Obviously, we're not going to have time today to talk about 48 articles. So we've kind of divided this up into two different cycles. The first thing that we're going to do is go over some trends and themes that we saw throughout the year and discuss some articles that were published on Hackaday about those topics. And then we're going to finish up with our favorite hacks and our favorite original content articles from the past year.
Sounds great. Let's get started.
All right. So what's the first topic?
First on the list, this has been a big year in space. There's been a couple private companies doing space stuff, and there's more coming up. And I think that's going to be a very interesting future world where space is full of not only international groups of nations working together, but also companies trying to put up rockets for money.
Well, yeah, and I think, you know, that part of it didn't like start in 2018. Like, we've heard about SpaceX for a long time and Blue Origin and Virgin Galactica, is that what they call it? But it seems like this year's the year that a ton of utility is coming out of it. You're seeing these new developments being used. So I think this is actually the area where engineering is being shown the most. And we see things like SpaceX is actually reusing a lot of its hardware. So I know Tom Nardi ran an article about catching nose cones as they come down so that they can reuse them. They already do reuse them. They pull them up out of the ocean, but there's a lot of rework that has to go on since they've been submerged in salt water. And so now they're actually trying to use balloons and gliders and a huge net on top of a cargo ship to catch these nose cones.
What I thought was really neat about Tom's article on that was that he pointed out that that's a really old plan. To do that at all is out of NASA in the 60s. And they just gave up on it because it wasn't worth the money back then. They had enough money that they could throw the rockets away.
Yeah, it's interesting what happens when you don't have the government coffers behind you.
That's right, when you're trying to make a buck by doing it.
Yeah, I mean, we'll put all these links in the show notes. There was another one on this about the second stage recovery of these rockets as well. And just in general trying, we had the space shuttle, which went up and came back down and was refitted and used again. But I like this idea of modular parts for these rockets because you can use them in different formats with different rocket sizes. They're a lot faster to respin than an entire ship like the space shuttle was. And just kind of an exciting look at something other than just one use, single use rockets.
Yeah, exactly.
I know both of us, one of our favorites this year was talking about the the Tesla sports car that was flung into space, and that's because Jenny took on an article about it.
Yeah. My favorite thing about that one, something I didn't know, well, slash, hadn't thought of at all. If you read the popular press on that, it was like, oh, he's throwing up a sports car, that crazy Musk. But if you are putting up a rocket that may or may not work, if you're doing a trial stage, nobody is going to put their super expensive satellite payload into it. And so it's traditional to test these rockets with cement or something like that, or just a payload full of water. And in that light, I thought Musk's choice to put up a car is, yeah, a little bit flashy, but it's by no means crazy. And it's actually just a reflection of when new rockets are being tried out, you don't want to put up something valuable in there. And he looked around. He's like, what have I got a lot of? Let's see.
I had never heard the term mass simulator before, which apparently that's what it is when you put up a payload and you just put up like a bale of cement. They call it a mass simulator. But I do think it is a little risky. So I read that book, The Martian by Andy Weir, which I think was really accurate in a lot of its science stuff. And it talked about like load shifting and that sort of thing when a rocket went up, and they actually lost a rocket because of that. So I think to put up this oddly shaped piece of mass that's not necessarily designed for space is a weird thing, but it worked out.
Yeah, they tied it down real well.
This kind of leads into my big theory about Elon Musk. I think Elon Musk is the reincarnation of P.T. Barnum. And I'm wondering if that's why we're hearing a lot of about the space stuff, is that Musk's kind of like one of his primary roles is like to get through the noise floor and to break out with a lot of this stuff. And he and his team do interesting things with this. So like the Tesla Roadster went up, but it wasn't just the Tesla Roadster. Apparently there's a teapot in the glove box, which is, there's a story behind that I don't want to go into because we don't have time. There were things written on the circuit boards. Like there's just a bunch of Easter eggs hidden in there, which takes kind of more of a dry engineering story and makes it into like a delightful entertainment story, which I think is good. I think science and engineering should be entertaining. And so this is putting a lot of pressure on state actors. So just, I think, a couple weeks ago now, NASA announced that they're going to return to the moon, and they're going to do it on the backs of Lockheed Martin and a few other private companies. So I think it's really good to see, you know, that we're kind of pushing beyond putting telecom satellites in space and going to do more exploration and hopefully manned missions. All right, well, we should probably move on to the next topic. There are a bunch of other space stories that I just kind of want to blast through before we do. So obviously the Soyuz rocket aborted launch was that September? I can't even remember now. Oh, it was October. That was a big one, and it was really great to see everyone is safe there, and the teams and the systems that they had in place all worked. We saw some great coverage from Tom Nardi on the implication for the International Space Station and on the quick turnaround by Roscosmos. Is that what it is? The Russian space agency. Yeah, to investigate that and turn it around. There was a bunch of news this year about stuff that's already in space. So there is a group of researchers who are trying to figure out how we could take care of our space garbage problems, and they actually developed a satellite that acts like a garbage truck, and this year launched it up there, and it will find like a piece of uncontrolled space garbage, like a satellite that has gone offline, and like launch a net around this thing and like deorbit it that way. And it's like straight out of Bond. It's really crazy.
Yeah, totally. I was surprised to learn, but I guess it makes a total amount of sense, that once you put something up in orbit, it takes just about as much energy to pull it back down. And so a lot of these satellites that are in non-decomposing orbits up there, we're going to have to shoot up a bunch of fuel to zoom the thing back down into Earth. And that's a real problem issue. And people say it's getting crowded up there. I've never been.
Well, we were talking about this on a pitch meeting, and it came to mind that this is like, every time you have a car that you don't want to use anymore, you just park it in your backyard and hope that nothing bad happens while it's back there.
Put it up on blocks and hope the neighbors don't call the cops.
Space garbage. All right. We also saw a ton of probes coming down or going offline. So the Chinese space station Tiangong 1 came down. We saw a great article from Brian Benchoff on reaction wheels failing in space probes because possibly because of space weather. So when you have solar flares coming out, it was causing arcing in those bearings, which is interesting. And it doesn't look like that caused it to fail. But shortly after that article, Kepler actually went offline with a reaction wheel problem. And then also Hubble had the same thing. So it seems like those systems that are used to orient probes, the moving parts are a huge issue in longevity of the probe.
Yeah, it's funny to think of the big gyroscope up there being the engineering problem. Once you've gotten, you know, a space telescope up, it's funny to think of it being, you know, bad bearings that bring it down. But suppose it's true.
All right, moving right along. What's next on our list?
Let's see. Back closer to home, I'm interested in home automation stuff. And this year I've seen a big shift toward, I guess, Wi-Fi. Everybody's, at least on Hackaday, is building stuff with Wi-Fi and moved away from the Zigbee and other. There have been a ton of MQTT projects that I've seen posted up. And that's really interesting to me. That's what I use at home. Because it's the simplest and most transparent transport you can think of, and that's really awesome. It's super, super hackable. A lot of people have been using Node-RED or OpenHAB, OpenHAB, which are kind of graphical front ends to handle the nitty-gritty. I'm old school slash stupid and just have a bunch of Python scripts running on my server that does it all, but it's completely ad hoc and non-scalable. And I see why people would want a nice graphical front end. But it's really interesting to see so many hacks at Hackaday that don't even mention these technologies anymore. It's just an aside. It's the hack's about a garage door opener. And then along the way, it's like, oh yeah, and I used MQTT to tie this into my, you know, my general overall home automation system. I think that's really a neat change that we're starting to think of the getting things done rather than the how we're getting them done.
Yeah, I think that Wi-Fi part of it is really interesting because there was kind of like a battle of the wireless protocols. And, you know, I looked at, for my own house, at getting some like smart light bulbs, and then you needed to get like a hub to connect to them, like the Wink hub system. And I'm like, well, I don't really want to get a hub. And so I wonder if that's part of what's driving this move towards Wi-Fi, because everyone has a Wi-Fi router basically everywhere you go. People don't necessarily have a Zigbee router.
Yeah, it's just a lot easier. It's the new lingua franca of home automation. Anyway, I'm stoked to see the community kind of coordinating slowly and randomly around the technologies that make sense.
So that's more on what you can do in your own on your own bench. But we've seen a lot of big moves in the silicon market as well. And I think it's kind of interesting that you were telling me you think the year of the FPGA is coming.
yeah, so the traditional joke, right, is that this is going to be the year of Linux on the desktop. And I think it's been the year of Linux on the desktop since 1998. And every year, somehow, Windows continues to exist. I've called the year of hackers taking over FPGAs a couple times now. And I think it's still 2018 is over. And at the beginning of 2018, I probably would have said it was the year of the FPGA in hacker projects. And so I'm going to push that off to 2019. But I've got a bunch of good reasons to think that it should be.
Yeah, and I want to hear those reasons, because I think there are just so many difficult barriers to getting into FPGAs. How are we going to get past those?
Yeah, Mike is an FPGA skeptic. do you ever like work on a project with a microcontroller and you're like, ah, damn it, I just need more pins? Or
more speed. I get it.
If I could definitely toggle this faster, I would be able to do something significantly cooler. Or
yes,
why can't these things all do it at the same time, right? And so these are the advantages that FPGAs bring to them. And the problem is, of course, like you said, that programming FPGAs, I've done stuff in Verilog, it's a pain in the butt. And it's a very different perspective from programming kind of sequential C programs where it's like, do this, then do this. And instead in Verilog, you have to say, do it all at once and hope that things synchronize right.
Well, I do think that that's interesting, because wouldn't you say that programming in C, like at a low level on microcontrollers without a bunch of peripheral libraries, that's very hard as well?
It's definitely similar level of confuseration. But I think what happened in microcontrollers is that you saw things like Arduino coming up with big libraries. So now it's just like, oh, I have this screen. I'll just, you know, import that library, type, done. And I think we're just on the cusp of seeing something like that in FPGAs. At least I'm hoping. And I've got a couple reasons. Let me run through them real quick. One is that we've seen a bunch of soft CPUs, and I think they're starting to get a little more mature, and they're certainly starting to get vendor support. On the fancy end of things, Intel / Altera has a NiOS 2 soft CPU, and if you're not familiar with FPGAs, they're just logic and whatever they do, whatever it is that you tell them to do, basically. And one of the things you can tell them to do is to assemble into a CPU or assemble into a facsimile of a microcontroller, and then you can program essentially your own peripherals outside of that. So you can make kind of, you know, you want 6 SPIs instead of 2, you can just instantiate them all. And so soft CPUs let you have the kind of comfort of programming the internal emulated CPU and then fanning out into the FPGA peripherals. So that's NiOS 2 from Intel Altera. ARM has just made its M1 and M3 cores available for Xilinx FPGAs, so Altera's arch nemesis. And then in the open source world, we've been seeing a lot of action, and it's basically based around Lattice Semiconductor's FPGAs because Clifford Wolf and his iStorm project, he wrote developed an open source compiler and entire, they call them flows in FPGAs, an entire tool chain to go from code to running on an FPGA. And that's done a lot to kickstart open source interest in these things. And he recently put out a Pico SoC or whatever he's calling it now. It might be a Pico V. Anyway, it's a RISC-V soft core running inside an FPGA. So not only do you get an open source compiler toolchain for the FPGA, but you get an open source CPU running inside this thing. I think this is going to be a very powerful combination. And I know that their team's working on porting similar stuff over to other FPGAs soon. And if the day comes when you can run a given soft core in any manufacturer's FPGA, the world will be a crazy different place.
So are they like locked in by architecture at this point? Like if you're using Altera versus Xilinx, you can't cross IP?
That's correct. Yeah, the manufacturers all want you to use only their programming tools, and they keep their synthesis, which is how you go from the code into aligning gates and lookup tables and stuff. They keep that stuff secret and under wraps. And the project that the iStorm did for the Lattice chips ended up writing basically an open source synthesizer and placer and all that. Anyway, what this opens the door for is the next layer, which is something like an Arduino, something like an open source, hacker-driven, community-driven level where you're doing the not just the soft CPU, but also the peripherals. And that's the day I want to see, when I can just download a CPU into the FPGA and then download one or two peripherals that I know somebody's written and I know they work and et cetera. And I think we're getting close. And one other sign that we may be getting close is that Arduino entered the game. And we covered that a lot, actually. The Arduino board that has an FPGA on it. And Al Williams, for instance, did a couple hands-on with it. He emerged kind of skeptical from it. It was harder to do than he thought. And he ran into Verilog faster than he wanted to. But I think with Arduino's kind of software and library development force behind things, that's going to help push this in a more usable direction too. So I don't know.
Yeah, so Brian did an interview at Maker Faire Bay Area when they announced that Vidor board.
Yeah.
And one of the things that they mentioned is they're planning to have a graphical interface so that people that aren't good with the hardware description languages can like drag and drop IP onto it. And I think if you are able to pull that off and then have, you know, Arduino's reach behind it, that could be a game changer.
Yeah. I mean, I think just writing the libraries is the important stuff. And if you put a graphical overview on that, then, you know, that just makes it even easier.
Yeah, because, I mean, what are we talking about as far as, like, attaching a peripheral to a core? It's like black boxes, right? It's like, what are the parameters and what are your function calls?
Yeah, absolutely. It's which wires do I hook up to what? Anyway, we'll see. Anyway, I am wrong about this year being the year of the FPGA, but I'm still holding out hope for 2019. And if that fails, I'm going to hold out hope for 2020, I swear.
Well, I guess continuing on our Silicon adventure here, the beginning of the year was marked with some really crazy news about Silicon bugs. We saw Intel chips affected by Meltdown and Spectre, and I think other architectures didn't get off scot-free on these either, but you need to go back and read about those. We also later in the year saw one called Foreshadow, which is these are all like speculative execution vulnerabilities within the silicon themselves. So like there are branch predictors inside of these chips that are trying to like get speed ups by figuring out choices before they're actually made. And it's incredible to me that people are actually able to discover these issues, but I think that that kind of signals something big this year. It's that the ability for an individual researcher or a small research firm to look at very low level to look at how chips are designed and to look if there are security exploits in those chips has kind of, you know, come onto its own. And so I found that very interesting this year.
Yeah, absolutely. And more complexity and more cleverness in the name of getting speedier makes more holes that the hackers can get their hands into too.
So. Yeah, I mean, we should have known these were coming because I think a favorite pastime of a lot of people who work with microcontrollers is reading the errata for those microcontrollers. And it's like horrifying to see some of the stuff there. It's like, you read this errata and it's like, when you do these things in this order, it corrupts the program memory. And it's like, what?
Yeah. Oh, dear.
Oh, no, that's not good. But I also think, you know, we've seen for years things like the Chip Whisperer, which was placed in the top five for the Hackaday Prize, I think, in 2014.
Yep.
Which is like a side channel glitching, you know, brownout and power channel glitching to find security in chips. Like there are people who are spending a lot of time looking into these techniques and building tools that can be used to test them and make sure that your chips aren't vulnerable. But when you have something so incredibly complex, like, you know, the processor that is in your computer or in your phone, these have been built on years and years and years and years of design, and there are dragons in there somewhere.
Probably, even if it takes 10 or 15 years to ferret them out. Let's see, completely changing gears. One of the things that I thought Hackaday did really well this year was our Profiles in Science series. We've been running biographies of not so famous scientists because, frankly, you've all heard the stories about the famous ones. We're not going to tell Newton again. So we've been doing stories about lesser told scientists. I think this is a really good thing to do because, honestly, these giant headline breakthroughs are, of course, important. And I'm not going to say that Einstein didn't contribute to science or Marie Curie didn't contribute to science. But science is this cumulative thing where everybody's building on everybody else's work and they're all working together. And I think that kind of social aspect is super important. And so I think it's very important for us to sing the praises of scientists you haven't heard of. And I think that's important both because it might inspire people who don't think that they're going to be the next Einstein, which I think is entirely rational because nobody's going to be the next Einstein. Nobody's going to be the next Marie Curie, right? So I think it's important to give people role models that are also maybe more approachable, more tenable. And from a writer's perspective, I think we've had a blast covering these stories. We like writing them a lot, and what feedback I've heard from our readers, they love them too. So I'm glad if we do even the tiniest little bit to steer a couple more people toward an interesting career in science if they had wanted one.
Well, yeah, and I think it's oftentimes, you know, the background stories, you know, the discovery, like, you know, the ramifications of the discovery you have. And, you know, I guess abstractly, you know, that somebody figured that out and a team of people carried it through. But to actually go and dig into that, I think is really special. And I think it's really important. I often say, you know, if you turn on ESPN, you're going to find like the world's weirdest stats about like every sports team and every player. And I want to hear those stats. I'm not so interested in sports. I want to hear those stats about these scientists.
Yeah, fair enough. I've learned a lot by reading them. So I've enjoyed it tremendously.
Yeah, I don't think we put down any favorites on this one.
I didn't, no.
No, I didn't either. We'll have to throw some favorites into it. I'm kind of scrolling through them now, and I'm like, yeah, these are all good. I don't know if I want to shout at any.
Yeah, it's hard to call a favorite. They're all tagged with the biography tag. So click on that, and you've got like 50 articles that you're going to have to read through. Save yourself a weekend and enjoy.
So looking more culturally, I think the biggest thing for electronics geeks everywhere this year was Badge Life.
Absolutely.
For anybody that doesn't know, Badge Life is, I would say, the art of spending way too much time and way too much money building a custom badge for an event that you're going to. And usually it's not just one badge, it's many, many badges. And if you are, if you really have this illness, it might be hundreds of badges.
Yeah, exactly. Back in the day, Nate, who ran SparkFun, did the speech about, if you want to make 10 of something, it's really easy. And if you want to make 100 of something, it's hard. And if you want to make 1 million of something, it gets easy again because you've got economies of scale. But then in the middle, there's this like pit of despair where you have to make 1,000 of them, which is just too many to do by hand, but you don't have the infrastructure to do it, you know, on a machine assembly procedure. And I think that's fun. And that's exactly where the scale of the badges falls, which I think gives people a good perspective on what it takes to make a small run hardware device.
Yeah, and I'm assuming everyone that would be listening to this knows, but just in case, so these badges are basically something that you can wear around your neck like a conference badge, but they're usually made of a printed circuit board and have some kind of electronics in it that either blink and delight you with their artistic nature, or have a puzzle or a game or some interactivity and intercommunication built into them.
Yeah, and I think it's particularly attractive to me because you get this kind of, I always call it full stack manufacturing 101, right? Like you get to do the design stuff yourself. And so you get to be creative on that part. And then you get to order all the parts. And so you get to go through the suffering there. And then you get to assemble them, which depending on how you do it, either involves making some awesome jigs or building up some of your own small scale machinery or just sucking it up and doing a lot of hand soldering. And then you get to sell them to people and watch people be happy. And so you get to do all of that yourself. Whereas maybe if you're an engineer working in a large company, you get to do one of these aspects. And if you're a hobbyist, you know, you don't get to do any of them during your day job. But it's nice to be able to have a project like this where it's not just, I'm going to plug an LED into a breadboard and make it blink. At the end of the day, you have something that's really concrete and awesome and a finished product. And, you know, you and a small group of friends did everything every step along the way.
Yeah, and I think there are people who have these jobs who are really good at their one particular thing and are just bored. And so on the side, they're doing that. These other things, the Anod XOR team, a couple of them came to SuperCon this year and we're talking about, you know, their badge process. They're making hundreds, like 600 vendor badges or something like that. Theirs is an actual incorporated business. It's like an LLC in the state of California. And so they've gone pretty crazy with it. But I think the thing about Badge Life this year that makes it such a notable thing is it's just exploded with the number of people that want to get into it. So I would say there are at least two times as many people making badges this year as there were last year. And that number's probably in the low hundreds. And just estimates here. I tried to see as many of them as I could at DEF CON this year and ended up publishing four volumes of all the badges of DEF CON. It's packed full of pictures and stories of the creators, but I know it's not everything.
Yeah, it probably can't be. It's just so inspirational. But the burden, I think the barrier to do it is a little bit high, because there is this whole, again, full stack everything, you know, design, manufacturing, and on. Which is why I thought, actually, our own Brian Benchoff's innovation, the shitty add-on, was a bleep, was a great idea. Because what it is it's got power and I2C, and that's all. And you can make the badge add-on as complicated as you want or as uncomplicated as you want. And some of the ones I've seen that are really cool, they go and push it super artistically. So they spend a lot of time on the making the PCB look good. And then all they use is the power pins. They just plug it in and it's awesome looking and it blinks. Whereas other people use more of the communication stuff. That's kind of cool, I think. And actually, we saw so many shitty add-ons. And the reason we did is because it lowers the hurdle to get in low enough that, you know, anyone can do it.
Yeah, and I think it's easy enough that you're like, boy, if I don't do this, it's kind of a cop-out, so I should, like, do something.
That's probably right.
Drew from Oshpark was handing out proto boards in the shitty add-on form factor, and I actually used one of those to make a fiber optic add-on that used, do you know the Tindy I Can Learn to Solder badge?
Yeah.
Has the blinky eyes. I used one of those blinky eyes just to make the fiber optics blink. But the place where I got bit on this one is, since there's no mechanical fasteners for these, it's just like the four pins of the header. Like, I lost the thing. It fell off the badge at some point. I didn't notice, and it's just gone.
Wah, wah.
So I think Brian was talking about an upgrade to the header at some point that would have some mechanical fastener holes. But I'm not a reliable source of information on
this. This is why we have hot glue.
Glue your add-ons right on, rubber band, something like that. You know, the interesting thing is, I would bet there were 10 times as many people doing add-ons as there were doing badges this year. And I think that's really cool.
Yeah, I think that's really awesome.
That specification actually made it onto the official badge for DEF CON and onto the official expansion board for the Hackaday Super Conference badge. I'm not sure about Tour Camp. Was there I think there was an add-on header for that as well.
I don't actually know.
Yeah, well, I'm hoping all conferences that do badges have add-on headers, because it's delightful.
Yeah, it looked like a heck of a lot of fun.
So where do you think this badge life stuff is going? Like, what's the next big thing for it? Or are we over the hump now?
I think there's a lot of room for expansion. I mean, you said that there's twice as many people doing it as last year, and there has been tremendous growth in the community, but we're still talking small numbers. I would want to see... You know, do I want to see Arduino numbers of people doing this? Probably not. I don't think it's going to be tens of thousands, but I would be stoked to see multiple thousands of people making and trading crazy self-made bespoke hardware blinky things with each other. I think that's just so rad.
Yeah, you know, the speed and the economy of ordering circuit boards is incredible, to the point where I have the stuff to etch boards in my basement, and I just don't do it anymore.
This is going to start a fight. I don't think we should do this on the air, man. But I basically etch everything myself, because I can get it. I'm in practice. I can get it done in an hour, and I've got my first failed board in front of me within an hour and a half, and I know how to fix it and make the second failed board and then fix that. But I'm done with two iterations, you know, before the day's out.
Yeah, I guess the thing I'm getting to this isn't so much, you know, what the best way of doing boards is, as it is that it's moving the challenge away from, you know, these technical aspects of actually fabricating the thing to the more ethereal aspects of conceptualizing and implementing the idea itself.
Absolutely. And I'll be the first person to admit that my way of doing things is lame precisely because it doesn't scale. If you can hand your design, your PCB design, off to someone else and they can get it printed up, and, you know, 10 people prototype your hardware and make improvements to it and send those back to you, that's going to push the open source hardware community so much further, so much faster than one dude at home with etch-stained fingers. So I know I'm wrong, but I still put my designs up so other people can copy them.
I do, you know, I got to say, I love open source because when I run into a problem, I'm like, someone must have solved this already. Can't I just find the same module on their board?
Yeah, it's amazing how good ideas. It's again, it's like, it's open source. It's open source hardware. I saw this in the early days of the RepRap community where the best ideas implemented in this one printer would then just spread around to all the others just because people said, hey, that's a great idea. I should do that too. And you see this in the Badge Life stuff. I can remember when I first saw that array of LEDs where they're all on the 45-degree angle so that you can close pack them to each other and it makes them, you know, look like a better grid than if they were vertical because they're longer than they are wide, right? And the first time I saw that, I was like, wow, that's a freaking brilliant idea. And I've seen that, you know, 15 times, 20 times this year, because it's just a great idea and people are sharing great ideas.
Yeah. So head out and check out all of the Badge Life creations. I think it, like Elliot said, is a really great place to learn about what's going on. If you want to find out a little bit more about who the people are that are building these badges, check out the documentary that Sophie Kravitz made at DEF CON this year that interviews a ton of those people, including the toy makers who did the official DEF CON badge. And then we'll also link to the article on shitty add-on headers so you can design your own for the next thing you're going to.
Exactly. And speaking of accessible and awesome tech, I wanted to pick up a couple just loose categories of things that I've seen going on this year. The first of which is laser cutters are the new 3D printers. I've seen so many more laser cutter hacks this year, in particular working on the K40 laser cutters because they're cheap, affordable, and they don't work so well. So they've got a lot of work to be done on them. But I'm still very stoked to see this kind of community growing up around people working on improving their laser cutters. I know Adam Fabio finally bit the bullet and bought himself a K40, one of our writers, and wrote an article called Laser Noob about that. That's actually really good. I think nowadays 3D printers are almost to the point where they're commercial and not so much a hacker's only cool thing to do on the weekend. And I think these ghetto laser cutters and making them into something useful feels a little bit the way 3D printers felt to me 10 years ago. So get out there, buy yourself a cheap laser cutter and hack on it. And similarly, I think robotics is getting there too. And Mike, actually, you wrote a great story way early this year in January, the title of which was Remember When Scratch-Built Robots Were Hard to Do. And yes, I do remember. And it wasn't that long ago. And it's absolutely shocking how easy it is to put together a robot now. And so we see that all throughout the year in Hackaday. We see, you know, if you need an IMU, you don't have to look for an IMU chip. You just go, oh, I'll type eBay, IMU module gets sent to me. You need a CPU for the brain, same thing, an Arduino or a Raspberry Pi or any other kind of module. You need motor drivers. Oh yeah, motor driver module, check. You need the motors themselves are cheaper and more available than they ever have been. And it's gotten to the point where putting together something that used to be this real difficult work, just getting to the point that you could assemble the robot, is now quick and easy. And the last remaining hurdle, the hard part, is building a chassis. And if you've got a 3D printer, you just go boom and you print out a nice chassis design. And then you don't have to worry about measuring the distance between the motors and where all those holes go and stuff like that. That used to be hard work. And I think the end point of this is then you can get straight into doing something cool. And that's what I like to see. And that's what we've seen a lot of this year. I wrote down one, at least on our list here, about self-balancing robots. 5 years ago, building a self-balancer was hard work. Nowadays, a self-balancer is put together a bunch of modules you just bought and then work on the code if that's what's interesting to you. And off you go, you're rolling. And I just think that's so fantastic.
Yeah, self-balancer has been on my list of projects to do for a long time, and I am going to get around to that at some point. You know, in going with your thought of finding someone's 3D printed chassis and running with that, I think you can extend that idea to everything. So it used to be like, okay, I need a motor. Like, which motor do I need for my robot? And then it was really difficult trying to spec that and figure out where to order it from. And now you can go out and find 500 projects that have used motors and robots, and you can go and peruse them and find where the gotcha points are and where the really interesting things are. And this year I've seen a ton of like DC motors that have been combined with position sensors and like 3D printed brackets for them. So you end up with a really cheap, really easy to drive motor that has good precision and repeatability. And I think that's really transformational for, you know, building mechanical things.
Yeah, when the easy stuff gets easier, then the hard stuff becomes doable. And we start to see all of this like smart robot design. And I'm totally stoked about that. For me, a robot arm is on my to-do list. Self-balancers are cool, but I don't know what I'd do with it. A robot arm is even cooler, and I still don't know what I'd do with it. Pass me the shot glass, robot arm. I mean, what do you do with one? I think half of the work is programming it, and that's going to be fun, actually. I think that sort of thing's fun. But
the self-balancing robot shall have butter on the top of it for buttering your toast.
Exactly. Yeah. I just want a robot arm because I have a four-year-old son, and he thinks a robot arm would be the coolest thing in the world. And I'm a grown-up four-year-old, and I think a robot arm would be the coolest thing in the world. All right. Shall we get on to our favorite hacks and articles?
Yes. We'll have Drumming Tesla give us a drum roll here. And
we need move on theme, to music theme music interlude.
Yes, we'll add that in post. So how do you want to do this, Elliot?
Do you want to do favorite articles by Hackaday folks first?
Yeah, let's do that. This is kind of a quirky one, but among my favorite articles of the year is one Tom wrote called "They're Putting Soy in Your Wires, Man." And it's because I put out Christmas lights every year, and every year something, some rodent, eats the insulation on my extension cord. And then I'm like, well, there's exposed, you know, 110. I need to throw that away and get a new one. I'm like, what's going on? And it never occurred to me to think, like, what is it that makes the rodent want to eat that? But it's, they're actually putting soy, which is a food good, into these wires. And it's like sustenance for, you know, mice.
That made me laugh so much. I live in Munich in Germany, which is kind of in the south and has the same reputation as the south of America does too, being a little bit rural. And the joke here is these martens, they're these little ferret-like animals that run around and they eat the wires in your car. And so when your car doesn't start, you know, it's because of the martens. And actually, if you look around our neighborhood, people put these chicken wire things out underneath their cars at night so that the martens don't climb up in there and chew their wires. It's a thing.
I've run into a ton of people since reading this article who have told me, like, yeah, I just spent hundreds of dollars getting my wiring harness replaced on my car because something ate it.
Yeah, I thought that was a hilarious article.
Another one that was a big favorite of mine was by Sven Gregory called "The Basics and Pitfalls of Pointers in C." Now, I consider myself to be a pretty decent C programmer for microcontrollers, and I believe I have a good handle on pointers and I understand them. I understand them well enough to know the parts that I'm going to get myself into trouble on, and so I always go and look those up as I get to them. And this article seems to very concisely and in a straightforward way explain what all of those edge cases that you have to watch out for are.
Yeah, I love that article. I wish I had written the pointers in C article.
I also loved the art that Joachim did for it, which is like a Monopoly board, and the shadow being cast by the Monopoly piece is a Jolly Rancher.
Yeah, totally. That's really cool. Super subtle.
And then a fairly new addition to the Hackaday team, but boy, does he fit here really, really, really well, is Drew Luttrell has been writing a series about the different things designed into game consoles. And one of my favorites this year was one called "That Time Atari Cracked the Nintendo Entertainment System," which kind of goes into this, you know, the original NES had some like gold seal certification for its games, which is basically like a licensing agreement. And if you wanted to write games for that console, you had to pay the licensing fee. And Atari either didn't or wasn't approved to get into that program. And so they actually reverse engineered the copy protection or the like authenticity protection in the chip on the Nintendo board and like hacked away around it. Also, great art from Joe Kim on this one as well.
Let's see. I'll do some of my favorite OC pieces of the year real quick, because Drew actually wrote one of my favorites, which was, remember when Blockbuster Video tried burning game cartridges on demand? And I had no idea, actually, that this happened. I should have been around at the time. I don't know. But Blockbuster Video used to be a video store where instead of beaming videos to you over the magical internet, you used to actually have to go there and get them yourself. And the and back in those dinosaur days, video games were printed on cartridges. They had ROMs inside them, and you'd plug them in, and it would play the thing. And the idea here was that you could make a chain of essentially ROM burning huts where people would burn the games on demand for you. That was a great historical article. I thought that was really fun.
Well, it was like early 90s, and they were talking about using like a fiber connection to the store to get the games off of a server. So like predating any type of broadband.
Yeah, exactly. That was the big trick, was keeping the stores up to date with all of the latest ROMs and being able to burn them out for people. And what killed the business model in the end? It was the CD, right? It was the PlayStation, essentially.
Yeah, they just couldn't keep up with technology. If you think of how fast consoles were coming out with just brand new media each time.
Yeah.
You know, at first, all of the discs were different technologies, and then you went to optical media, which had copy protection rolled into it.
Yep. Yeah. Anyway, that was a great article. Go read it. Another of my favorites, actually, for weird and personal reasons, this is how the Hackaday community works. Someone wrote us in and said, hey, I've got this old 1970s organ that isn't working, and it's not working because it's got this old chip in it called a top octave generator, and it's busted. Can you fix it? And I'm like, huh, I bet I could do that in, you know, with a little microcontroller real quick. And I thought about it, and I couldn't. So I wrote up and asked Hackaday. The timing ends up being really tight on it, to make it sound right without jitter. And so I wrote up and asked Hackaday, saying, hey, can anyone think of how to do this? And we got a taker. And the solution is absolutely brilliant. And it teaches you enough about how to do this kind of just-in-time calculations. It's really clever. It's got a super fast loop that executes straight out of memory, and then when it knows it has enough time to do some computation, it bails out of the super fast loop, fills up the buffer so that it's got more, the fast loop has more information to work on, and then it keeps working on it. And so this article ended up being, first of all, a question from the community. Second, I was like, hey, I can do that. And then it turned out I couldn't. And I'm like, hey, how do we do this? And then someone solved it brilliantly with some techniques that you need to know if you're doing time-critical microcontroller programming. So I may have written the article, but it was one of my favorites. And I'm not ashamed to say that the reason it was one of my favorites is because of all the people working together in the community to make it work. I also made an organ out of it, because at that point I just couldn't resist.
And if you want to learn more about cycle counting, that's the place to go watch. That's really cool.
Yeah, it was really sweet.
What about the art for that one, Elliot?
You suggested it, man. I had no idea that Elton John wore a duck suit. And
did I suggest it?
Mike Stitch, ladies and gentlemen, said, you got to give Joe that picture of Elton John in a duck suit. And the rest is history.
You and I must have been Googling organ, like pop culture organ or something like that, and came up with that picture. But anyway, I don't remember where the art came from, other than once I saw it, I was like, oh my God, Joe, how did you do this?
Yeah, exactly. And it's worth mentioning at this point that if you right click on any of our banners, you can pull up the link and get that in its full resolution if you absolutely need to have Elton John in a duck suit on your wall.
So that's two. What's your third fave OC article.
Last but not least, actually back to home automation a little bit, was two articles written by Inderpreet on Bluetooth low energy stuff. These interested me because I wanted to learn about Bluetooth low energy. His first one was just getting into BLE, and then the second article is this fantastic, easy to read tie together of how to use BLE with Node.js as a backend and MQTT again, everyone's favorite Wi-Fi transport, to do a kind of Internet of Things, phone, physical devices mashup. And I think that combo is super powerful. And this article was really written because he was just playing around with it. But he got all of the details put together for how you would do something like this if you wanted to. So I think that's super worth your time to read. And I actually need to go and do my homework on that one.
I'm the same way. I need to work through that stuff. If you're going to be an embedded person, you have to, you know, cut your teeth on Bluetooth low energy at some point.
Yeah, I think it's, I will work on that. That's maybe my New Year's resolution is learn BLE.
All right. So quickly through the runner-ups. For me, I had three of them. Quinn Dunkey has been working on a great series on machine tools. The first one is called Precision on Which Civilizations Are Built. Go and check that out. Delightful articles on basically focusing on lathes and acquiring your first lathe and getting up and running on it. Christian Trapp wrote a really fun one called Beeping Enemy into Submission, which is a story about how runway locators worked during the Second World War and how enemies on different sides of the front were trying to spoof those so that they could take out the ability for aircraft to be involved in the war. An interesting radio / technology thing there. And finally, Jenny List wrote one that's kind of a series between several different authors on crimp connections. And Jenny went and took the cheapest crimpers and the medium price crimpers and the most expensive crimpers and crimped a bunch of test crimps and then hung them all from a ladder and used, you know, poured water into a bucket until they broke to test them mechanically, and then also tested them electrically to see what could be put through them. A huge commitment to it. I'm kind of hoping she'll at some point, you know, do a bunch of refinements to this and then work on a paper for the Hackaday Journal on it.
Okay, let me do my runner-up articles. Mine are also some small mini-series. Dan Maloney has been doing a series on mechanisms, which has been really neat because I'm not a mechanical engineer. And if you want to get into this and in the arcane end of the pool, you should definitely check out Mechanisms Mechanical Seals, because he goes about explaining all the different ways you can seal two things together that need to move against each other and need to hold pressure. It's the sort of thing that a non-mechanical code type person like myself thinks is really fascinating. But his whole mechanism series has been working through all sorts of low-level mechanical engineering that I probably need to know, and maybe you do too. Tom Nardi's been doing a mil-spec teardown. Basically, he keeps his eyes out on eBay for any kind of old surplus military gear and takes it apart and has a look inside. Look for mil-spec teardown. A really neat one was on the CP142 range computer. But what's surprising in these is sometimes you find really obviously military engineering, and other times you find just kind of consumer plus. And it's kind of funny to speculate on where you need to have it super hard and where you don't. So those are fun just to see what's inside. Another on my short lists, Al Williams has been doing articles on quantum computing, and one of his articles, Quantum Weirdness in Your Browser, really got into my head finally what exactly a quantum computer is. And it's a lot more like the analog computers of old. It's not even really a computer. You have to wire these things up to do what they do, and then they only do what they do. It's not really, like, quantum computers aren't really general purpose computers in that way. But then they also operate strangely with statistics internally. So if you want to get a good hands-on explanation about how these things work and actually understand it by writing your own little program, which means wiring things up together to learn about quantum computing. I think his article, Quantum Weirdness in Your Browser, and that whole series is well worth your time. And last but not least, Sean Boyce wrote a great one on building a solar-powered spot welder, which is not something anyone needs, and I love it because of that. He had a bunch of like giant super caps, and he's like, what am I going to do with these? And he's like, maybe I can hook up solar panels. And so that's basically the article right there. He hooks up solar panels, tries to charge up some giant super caps, and makes some sketchy welds. Would you ever need a portable solar-powered spot welder? I'm going with no. But
well, isn't it that one where he saw a sale on the super caps, and so he just bought them, and then he had them, and he had to use them?
$4 super caps. What are you going to do? You have to buy them, right? Man,
I think the most creative stuff comes out of that. I mean, I ran into Mike Harrison at New York Maker Faire this year, and he had like the world's smallest, totally contained blinking LED, which he built because he saw a tiny, tiny, tiny super cap come up, and he was like, I need to buy some of these. And then he's like, what am I going to build with them?
This looks like this is a hammer. Where find me a nail?
Yeah, yeah. That's my favorite kind of hack, I think, is that you have to come up with a reason to do it.
I was going to say, I really love that mode of hacking. And this article also has super art by Joe Kim. We're like, hey, Joe, get us a picture of somebody with a solar-powered spot welder. And he did it, and it looks awesome. So kudos all around.
All right, so now the final category, which is favorite hacks. So this isn't so much about the articles as much as the hacks that we're covering in them. For me, I think head and shoulders this year above any other hack I saw was the first lithographically produced homemade IC. Sam Zalouf did this in his garage, and just by itself, it's an amazing hack, and I love it. But I also feel like a really close, like, personal attachment to it, because some of my earliest memories of like YouTube, or like watching videos online, was watching Jerry Ellsworth do semiconductor experiments in her garage. And that is kind of what inspired Sam and helped Sam start out and to go down this whole path. And you know, in addition to this article, you can check out his talk from the SuperCon this year, which I thought was just fantastic.
Yeah, that was an absolutely brilliant talk. It's worth noting that he's at least at the time he did it, he was in high school. He's now first year in college. But the first hacker we know to have produced their own, etched, built, designed their own IC in their own garage was a senior in high school, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, incredible. And, you know, that's something that would have taken a incredibly huge company 30 years ago can be done on a relatively reasonable single hacker budget.
You should really watch that talk. He did some super clever things to make that possible. And that's really just hacker spirit.
I also this year loved seeing the self-solving Rubik's Cube. So we've seen a ton of Rubik's Cube solvers over the years, and they're usually like a box, you know, that looks like a MakerBot cupcake that you would put the cube in, and it has like an actuator for each of the sides, and it moves it around. This takes all of that and puts it inside the cube itself. So to the unaware, it just looks like a Rubik's Cube. But when you mix it up and you just set it on the table and you wait like 5 seconds, and then it starts to move by itself until it's solved. Incredible stuff. And I think finally, and actually, Elliot poo-pooed me on the use of calling this art a little bit before, but I love to see the membership ring of the Electronic Illuminati. I actually wrote this article. It's about Zach Friedan's cyborg ring, which is two pieces of circuit board that use surface mount components mounted on edge to span between them, kind of like cordwood manufacturing. And then it goes on your finger, and it's addressable, so you have, I don't know, like 8 LEDs on it that scroll back and forth in like a Larson scanner pattern. I just loved it.
Oh, I think it's an awesome hack, and I think it's absolutely brilliant. And I don't think I was poo-pooing the artistic.
Well, you said it can't be art because it's useful.
Oh, that's not poo-pooing it. That's just definitional, man. Like,
oh, okay,
got it. This is the art community with their jizz jazz, not mine. If it has a function, it's craft. And if it doesn't have a function, it can be art, which is a totally bogus distinction, but it's the one the art world settled on. So no, I was just arguing for that. I think it's an awesome ring.
Yeah, I love it. It's great. What do you have on your fave hacks list?
Let's see. Best hacks. Man, it was so hard to pick. Again, this was picking it out of like nearly 3,000 hacks. I went for one that was just totally oddball, which was adding analog touch to nearly any mechanical keyboard. And just because this is something that I'd never thought of, I don't know if there's any practical use for it, but it's so awesome. The idea is if you have one of these mechanical keyboards that's got a spring inside, the spring is like an inductor. So you put some kind of inductive sensor underneath it, and you can tell how much that spring is compressed because it changes inductance as you push the key down. And you can get analog values. You can tell how deep the key is pressed at any given time. And there's a spiral coil on the PCB underneath that does the sensing. So it's actually really clever and not hard to do. And it made me wonder why these things don't exist at all. And the answer may be that the chips to do the inductive sensing are a little bit expensive, and it only does 8 keys and costs $2. So you're going to have 100 keys. You're going to spend a lot on those chips. But to have a fully analog keyboard, what would you do if you halfway press the key down? How would you have that be different from a full press? I have no idea, but I know I'd like to find out.
You should be able to multiplex that sensor, right?
Oh, yeah, totally. No, you can multiplex it, but then it lowers your scan rate. And so if you want super responsiveness, which fast typers do, or I don't know what you're doing with the analog data on it again. This is just I love this
one.
You
get an email and it has a rating on how much you meant it when you typed it.
Exactly. You could do caps lock if you pressed really hard, or you could do velocity sensitivity. You could tell how fast you're typing each key down, and you could do caps by doing velocity sensitivity.
We need a program that puts in an emoji based on the analog values from how you typed it.
Exactly. A quick press is this, a slow press is that. Yeah, I don't know. It's just so out there that I had to say I love it. The other types of hacks that I really love, besides the totally out there, are ones that teach you something. And a lot of these come to us because the person who did it wanted to learn something themselves and then wrote it up. One of my favorite examples of this was Tim Alex's Want to Learn Ethernet, Write Your Own Darn Bootloader, where he takes an AVR and an Ethernet board, one of those little cheap modules again, and wants to get it online, and writes the entire IP and Ethernet, and I guess he gets a trivial FTP in there so that he can upload code to the thing. And this is all on an AVR chip. And then because we were running the 1K challenge at the time, he manages to squeeze this code down to fit inside 1K. So
of course
there's absurdities on absurdities here in that he squeezes, he makes an AVR chip able to get on the internet functionally. But then he does it within 1K. It's just mind-blowing. But what you really need to do is go to his website and read this, because if you don't know about low-level networking, this will teach you everything about low-level networking in a very hands-on way. He's actually flipping the bits to make GPIOs go to do Ethernet. So wrap your head around that for a sec. It's a totally good read. I learned a lot from reading it. And the last one I put up again is mostly because there's a backstory. It's so hard to pick that I'm going with cheap and easy emotional connections to these articles. We wrote one that was called MIT Extracts Power from Temperature Fluctuations, and a bunch of people in the comments were like, oh, that's nothing. Here's some great ways to harvest energy from temperature and pressure fluctuations, and brought up a bunch of old clocks that are basically self-winding based on temperature variations of the day. And I ended up writing a post just basically summarizing the cool stuff that people brought up in the comments, called Mechanical Clocks That Never Need Winding, because I had no idea they existed. And one of these, the Beverly clock, has got a, it's got basically a bellows, sealed bellows that expands and contracts during the day and pushes a ratchet to lift the weights to make a mechanical clock swing back and forth. And it's really old and not super efficient. And apparently nowadays with air conditioning, temperatures stay too constant and it actually does need winding occasionally. But back when it was designed, we couldn't hold temperatures quite as constant, and a clock could wind itself by the temperature fluctuations during the day. And there were a couple other examples of these there, and I didn't know these things existed. I learned about it from reading the comments in Hagaday on another article, and I just thought that was super.
So this has been a fun view through the 2018 hacks that Elliot and I really liked at Hackaday. Of course, we couldn't do it without you. So keep putting out those projects, keep writing about them, sharing the interesting things that you're into and exploring, because people do want to know about it. And don't be shy about sending them in. We have a very active tips line at tips@hackaday.com. Let the writers and editors know about it. Of course, if you want to get in touch with us about this podcast, you can reach us at editor@hackaday.com. And keep your eye on Hackaday in the coming year.
Yeah, keep on hacking.